Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. Today we continue our conversations with the Marine Biological Laboratory's Falmouth Forum Lecture Series. Today, Frank Snowden, author, and Andrew Downey, Orrick Professor Emeritus of History and History of Medicine at Yale University. His latest book is Epidemics and Society, From the Black Death to the Present. In it, he explores how mass infectious outbreaks affect society and the world's preparedness for the next generation of diseases. He examines several diseases as well as the strategies society has deployed to combat, prevent, cure, and even eradicate them. Professor Snowden, welcome.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be with you. Thank you for having me.
You bet. The book came out in October of 2019, just before the pandemic took hold. And the timing is pretty amazing in that you and many others had concerns a pandemic would come at some point, but you couldn't be certain of the timing. I think you liken it to a meteorologist who can predict a hurricane will hit the Caribbean, but not be able to say exactly when. So tell us what prompted the book.
The book actually grew out of my experience of teaching, and in particular, my students here at Yale were very concerned as the course began with the concern of students around SARS, which is to say that they discovered that there were lots of things in the curriculum with regard to infectious diseases in terms of science, that you could study the biology of the infectious diseases, but there was very little in the curriculum that tried to put them in a context in terms of their relationship with the economy, with society. This was something that was rather missing in the educational curriculum, and I would say this is true not only at Yale, but it is a very common factor. And so they wanted answers to the questions about SARS. They were very concerned with how did this happen? This is this sort of mental well-being of knowing not just if they're going to survive and what they can ask doctors about what they should do in terms of immediate emergency measures, in terms of therapy and all the rest, something historians can't do. Historians, however, can address what I think is part of mental well-being, which is contextualization, knowing why this is happening, what does it mean, how might it end, is it unprecedented, have other societies experienced the same? So out of that, I began to devote my full attention to teaching those very things. And that developed into the book that, as you say, I finished at a very ironic time, which is to say just 2 months before COVID-19 erupted in China.
You wrote in the preface, pandemics are not accidental or random events. Can you explain that?
Oh, yes, absolutely. I believe that what happens is that societies create particular vulnerabilities, that is to say, pathways through which pathogens, not all pathogens, because each society creates different vulnerabilities, but each society creates pathways that microbes can exploit to reach human societies and then to spread within them. Let me give as an example, I would say that Asiatic cholera reflected society in the era of industrialization, where it created pathways, rapid, unplanned urbanization led to these teeming, crowded, and very unhygienic dwelling places for masses of the population undergoing this transformation, and that was a perfect environment for diseases that spread through the oral fecal route, of which cholera and typhoid are the best examples. So it's no accident that the 19th century, which is a period of great industrialization and great urbanization, saw this is the most feared disease of the era, was Asiatic cholera, which returned in waves until people, society, undertook the sanitary transformation of urban cities by installing sewer systems, the regulation of domestic dwellings in terms of the number of people per room, streets were paved, swept, and cleansed. All of these measures were taken, and we see that the hygiene movement, the sanitary movement that swept the industrial world, has created enormously effective bulwarks against those particular diseases transmitted in that particular way. So we are not, in the industrial world at least, vulnerable to Asiatic cholera epidemics or typhoid. We live in a different kind of society. We have different vulnerabilities. Or if you move forward to another case to illustrate the point, to the Spanish influenza, that was driven by total industrialized warfare. And it was warfare that created the conditions by which the disease reached communities through the movement, deployment of troops overseas and all around the world, and then the concentration of people on the home front in huge factories and crowded working and living conditions, and then, of course, the military bases, the trenches, the unsanitary crowding together of masses of young men in enormous, unprecedented numbers. And that was the great driver of the Spanish influenza. And not surprisingly, the disease receded and then ebbed away with the ending of the war and the coming of peace and the removal of that great driver on which it depended. Now I'd say that we're in a different era that I would call COVID-19, the first great pandemic of the global era. That is to say that we are still vulnerable to infectious diseases. We're not so vulnerable to cholera and typhoid, for example, but we're tremendously, our great vulnerability is to pulmonary viruses transmitted through the air by droplets and aerosol. And we are that vulnerable in part because we are so enormous in terms of our numbers, both absolutely and in terms of dense urban cities and megacities around the world. And they're all linked by the vast movements of migrants, refugees, mass tourism, traveling at lightning speed almost by jet airplane. So we've created a very different society with very different vulnerabilities. And so these are not random events. They actually follow a logic. We've created the vulnerabilities and the pathways by which COVID-19 moves in our midst. That it spilled over from animals, that's because we invaded animal habitat and are doing so systematically as we expand and expand industrial activity the expansion of cities. And that makes us vulnerable to spillover. And then once the spillover has occurred, the microbe finds a waiting environment in a crowded city that it can exploit by being transmitted through the air and then moving around the world by jet airplane. Because we have so many people, so many investments in interconnectedness around the world. So that, I think, is the great vulnerability of our era. And I would argue that, that this kind of disease would not have thrived in the era of industrialization. So I think there's a logical connection between the kind of society that has been created and the kinds of diseases that the people living in them experience.
We've had a number of what we might call dress rehearsals with epidemics like SARS and Ebola. In 2005, Congress held a hearing on pulmonary viruses. And we had the World Health Organization in 2008 had the World at Risk report. So why were we not better prepared for this pandemic?
I would say that that's a very important issue as we're thinking about the future. How can we do better? And I would say that this time around, it really was not due to any simple factor. It was a perfect storm of colliding, converging weaknesses in the way that we as a society conduct our business. The sorts of things, some of them are cultural attitudes. A lack of belief in science is clearly one. And we saw that early on in the United States with the idea that this was a Chinese flu, or it isn't, of course, a flu, but it's sometimes called that. Lack of belief in science was one, a culture of individualism, of not believing and working together, but rather rating one's own freedom as it's thought above the collective good, so that masking was politicized and was seen as an invasion of a person's liberty, and the same with the sort of public health restrictions. So part of the problem was that. Another problem was a primacy of the economy. That is to say, we prioritize the economy above public health. The ancients taught us a long time ago that public health should be the primary law, the topmost important law. And we refused to accept that, at least many people did, and thought instead that the economy was far more important. And so there was a great pushback against any measures of public health that impinged on the economy, and the constant pressure to reopen. And we see that from the beginning of this pandemic, and we see it now. And one is aghast, I think, with what the state of Texas has just done, which is to end all mandates for masking and social distancing and to open everything immediately in the midst of what still is an ongoing crisis. I think we had fragmented political leadership, which is a feature that was noted. There were a whole lot of plans drawn up between 1997 and avian flu, the first event, dress rehearsal, and 2020. And these stressed that we needed to have a centralized direction in the event of a public health emergency. We needed that in terms of organizing the response, but we also needed it in terms of promoting a messaging and informing the public and explaining what was going on. And instead, we found ourselves not having heeded those words, but rather still having no actual leadership centralized in place. And everything, our response was fragmented among the different 50 different states, municipalities, school boards within them, all saying different things, having different policies, and that really unhinges a response and feeds on the individualism, because people don't know whom to listen to. They're not convinced. They don't know how to respond. And that's been true since the beginning of our experience. Another problem was structural. And that is to say, our healthcare system, which was focused entirely. We have, this is one of the great paradoxes, isn't it? That we have here one of the great healthcare systems of the world, and yet we experience this tremendous, one of the great hospital systems and research science systems, but it's focused on treatment and not on prevention. And so we found that our hospitals were not entirely unprepared for surge capacity and all of the rest. And this is true on the front lines that were called upon to face the pandemic. Two of the great frontline institutions were hospitals and nursing homes. And there, the profit motive had squeezed out preparedness so that both hospitals and nursing homes, I choose those, the hospitals because they were so essential, and nursing homes because there was a real Holocaust in the nursing home. 40% of all those who died in the United States were residents in nursing homes, and there had been lots and lots of warnings that nursing homes were not prepared for infectious diseases, and both hospitals and nurses, the profit motive, had urged the easing out of surge capacity, of personal protective equipment, of training in emergency response, squeezed out the numbers of skilled, highly trained nurses, that is, registered nurses, who deal with and know about and are trained to deal with infectious diseases, and reliance instead on an array of virtually untrained nursing aides. And so when the disease confronted the nursing homes, they were simply totally unprepared. And although there had been flashing yellow lights in them for 20 years and more, so it was extraordinary that we weren't prepared. And we also did, I think, during this period, we had, how did authorities respond to the warnings? They responded, and maybe this is human nature, feast and famine. Immediately after the warning and a flashing yellow light, there were budgets drawn up and appropriations made for public health and plans drawn up for biodefense. But a year or two later, the famine came. There was the appeal of budget cutting to save funds, the appeal of not science, but rather, again, of the economy and business as usual. So what we lacked above all was any kind of sustained commitment to public health, despite all of the dress rehearsals and the warning signs.
Yeah. You're listening to The Point. It's our monthly Friends of the MBL Falmouth Forum conversation. We'll have more with Frank Snowden, Yale a medical historian, after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. It is our monthly conversation with the Marine Biological Laboratory's Falmouth Forum Lecture Series. We're talking with Yale historian Frank Snowden. His book is Epidemics in Society, From the Black Death to the Present. If you'd like to join a conversation, you have a comment or a question, 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. You touched on the Spanish flu for a minute there, and a lot of people have compared this pandemic to the Spanish flu, but very different. And if we're looking at response, a better comparison might be the bubonic plague, and that response was perhaps more similar to what we're seeing with COVID, right?
Well, I would say there are grounds for thinking that the Spanish influenza, it seems to have many similarities. It's not an outrageous comparison at all, because both are or seem to be similar in being pulmonary diseases, respiratory diseases, and that are transmitted through the air, and our congregate settings are places in which they both thrive. And then because the public health response, if you were to, let's say, to put into a time machine a citizen from Madrid or Valencia from the 15th or 16th century and bring them to a modern city, say New York, during this pandemic, they would see many similarities to things that they already knew in terms of public health, or the same as someone from the Spanish influenza joined them in the time machine. They would see people masking, social distancing, the bans on congregate living. And so there's a continuity of public health measures invented during time of bubonic plague that were frequently resurrected to deal with exotic invading diseases that people didn't comprehend. And so the Spanish influenza was a second time that one could mention when it seemed as though this was the direct ancestor of what we're facing now. As you've just said, it wasn't in so many other ways, but it did have certain ways in which it seemed similar, and also the pattern of coming in repeated surges or waves seemed to resemble what we're experiencing in terms of COVID-19. So I think there are grounds on one level to think that there are similarities, but we'd be very misled if we actually thought that they can be dealt with in the same way.
What about the response to the bubonic plague? What are the similarities there?
We see lots of similarities. First, it's the bubonic plague that gives one was an organized response. How should communities respond collectively to this kind of extraordinary disaster that was afflicting them? And they responded by inventing public health. The institutions of plague hospitals, plague costumes, we call it PPE, plague measures of distancing, banning assemblies, all of that. That was one of the responses. There are also other responses that are less, if we like, much less helpful and show our darker side. One of the problematic sides of human nature is the terror and fear that these events inspire and the stigmatization and violence that results when people try to blame other people in order to assuage their own anxieties and fear. So during the time of bubonic plague, especially during the Black Death, the early years, this was a time of a precursor of the 20th century onslaught on European Jews. The first sort of Holocaust, if we want to call it that, occurred during time of bubonic plague when Jews were accused of spreading the disease, the bubonic plague, in order to wipe out Christendom. And so there were enormous pogroms across Western Europe as a result. And we see that not the pogrom, no, thankfully, no. But we do see stigmatization as a common response. We saw the stigmatization, the blaming of homosexuals for HIV/AIDS. And now COVID-19, we see that it's considered by so many people, and not only in the United States, but especially here, where it feasts on a long-term anti-Chinese, anti-Asian stigma. And we see an upsurge of Asian Americans being assaulted in the streets, stabbed, knocked over, insulted, driven into traveling in groups because they're afraid on public transportation. There's this terrible upsurge then of stigma and blaming and violence against people who had nothing to do with the plague except that they were found in the wrong place at the wrong time. So that's another unfortunate, unhappy continuity.
Yeah. We're talking with Professor Frank Snowden. His book is Epidemics in Society from the Black Death to the Present. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. Talk a little bit about the importance of the World Health Organization.
Oh, right. This is one of the lessons that one needs to take away, one of the great takeaways of this particular pandemic, when we find that one of the great lacks of preparedness was one of international cooperation. And as I was saying, this is the first great pandemic of the globalized era. We're all in this together as a world, as a species on our planet. That is to say that when COVID breaks out in Wuhan on one day, it's in Milan virtually the next, and in New York a few days later. And so we're terribly interconnected, and we need, therefore, national boundaries are not recognized by the microbe. SARS-CoV-2, the pathogen that causes COVID-19, doesn't recognize barriers, walls, national borders. It finds a way, inevitably, to cross them. And so the point about that is that we need an international organization to direct and coordinate an international response. A healthy, well-funded WHO can play enormous roles. It can trace and track, encourage the collaboration of scientists to connect labs to each other, to share the genome. It can also help individual countries by providing them guidance on how to respond to this disease and ensure, for example, that one country's policies aren't in direct conflict with the policies of the country next door, the way we saw Belgium and the Netherlands. You cross a white line on a map and you have entirely different policies towards the disease that were entirely conflicting and undercut one each other. We also find that the WHO is a wonderful instrument for allocating resources. That is to say, it can ideally direct resources from those places that have the supply to the countries that are on the front line and need, say, PPE or vaccine now immediately. And the WHO can help to coordinate that in a way that no other institution can. It's also very important, and we see it now, of tracking. They just sent a mission to China to find out how the disease COVID-19 actually broke out and to trace it so that the lesson will be learned for public health and for epidemiologists, so they'll be more prepared next time around. So it also has a future-looking aspect to it. And then the WHO has played an enormous role, and if it were funded and if we hadn't withdrawn from it for a period, it would be in a better position to do such things as tackle the misinformation and to fill that gap with and the stigma that we talked about a minute ago, and to fill those gaps. So we need this instrument of international collaboration to coordinate a global response to a global threat.
Mm. Let's talk to Janet, who's giving us a call from West Tisbury. Good morning, Janet.
Good morning. Actually, your guest has answered a few of my questions already about the WHO, et cetera. But, you know, I'm really concerned. Who's working on this now, and what about the next SARS, perhaps SARS-3 with the variants that are abounding? And I don't understand why people weren't working on this. We've just explained, you know, the withdrawal from the WHO. It almost seems an impossible problem. I don't want to think that way, but yeah. I do.
I see, yes. Well, actually, it's the good news. There's good news and bad news. The good news is it's not an impossible problem, and there are lots of people who are now working, in fact, thinking about the future and thinking what we didn't do right this time that we could, and these are possible solutions. That is to say, one is to have surveillance on the front line of hotspots around the world where this sort of spillover is likely to occur, and to create surveillance there that will flash red light around the world, that there is a new risk that has emerged and that needs to be addressed immediately and contained. That's a very progressive response to this, and it's made possible by the development of genomic research. We're now in a better position, in other words, to practice surveillance around the world if we're prepared. Here's, again, the caveat. This is the bad news. It's up to us as people, and are we prepared to fund that sort of presence, that sort of constant vigilance? This was where we found ourselves caught completely off guard this time around. And there we can see that the vaccine companies are now thinking ahead, and they're thinking of this has never been done before, but they would like to think of the vaccine platforms that can be, if we like, capable of dealing with all coronaviruses. And so the question there, that seems like a possibility in the lab, but the research and the funding all need to be provided. And that's something, again, that's good news, but it's also bad news because it means we have to be prepared to invest in these activities.
Yeah.
I think a lot of our destiny is in our hands, and the point is, what are we as societies prepared to do about it? Are we going to learn this lesson? Are we going to ignore it?
Janet, thanks for the phone call. You know, you took part, you were part of a think tank that was organized by the World Health Organization this past summer. The first time historians were involved, right? It used to be just kind of medical people, so they're expanding the kind of information they're looking for, right?
Oh, absolutely. One of the lessons from this pandemic was that the WHO realized that it was filled with physicians and public health officials. And that's not in itself a bad thing. That's necessary and essential. But that left an enormous gap because part of the preparation in being trained as a physician or a public health official is not providing context to explain to people where this came from, how did it, is this ever happened before, how might it end? And so they found that it would be enormously helpful and indeed therapeutic to invoke the lessons of the past. And so for the first time, they decided that it was part of their function of public health to include looking at the history and drawing the lessons so that we wouldn't keep making the same mistakes as an institution and as a society. Mm-hmm. So the result was they set up a think tank, which included epidemiologists and public health people, but it also invited in for intensive discussions over a period of 3 months and lots of reading and discussion for the very first time about epidemic diseases and how what we could learn from the past that would inform the response to COVID-19 and to future pandemic emergencies.
Mm.
So yes, the WHO has moved in that direction, and I see that as enormously positive and constructive.
You're listening to The Point. It's our monthly Friends of the MBL Falmouth Forum conversation. We're talking with Professor Frank Snowden, author of Epidemics and Society from the Black Death to the Present. We'll have more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. It is our monthly conversation with the Marine Biological Laboratory's Falmouth Forum Lecture Series. We're talking with Yale historian Frank Snowden, author of Epidemics and Society from the Black Death to the Present. 866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. And Jane is calling from Centerville. Good morning, Jane.
Good morning. Thank you, Mindy, and thank you, Professor Snowden, for your great work and this interesting discussion. My background is actually in military medicine and public health, and I've been struck during this pandemic at how well centralized systems around the world have done better, whether they had a good initial response or a lagged in their response. compared to our system, which is so decentralized, unfortunately, with every state and in some ways every region picking their own response. But I'm thinking particularly about the vaccine rollout and how different it is in this country, although we're improving, compared to the United Kingdom. The United Kingdom had a similarly slow response in terms of lockdowns and public health warnings and mask enforcing and so forth to the U.S., and I think for a while was the second leading country in the world in terms of numbers of cases. But with their national health system, they've been able to do a very efficient job in getting vaccinations scheduled and deployed. I wonder if it doesn't illustrate a good idea for us going forward to have a national health system, if not during non-emergent times, at least during pandemics, so that once a pandemic or an emergency is declared, everybody has a role, like the reservists in the military, everybody has a role in the NHS, and the management of health in the country becomes centralized. I wondered if you've come across that idea or have any thoughts about it, and I appreciate your work on this issue, because we certainly need to learn from the past. Yeah. Thank you.
Thanks, Jane.
Thank you so much. I appreciate your question, and I think you've actually put your finger on one of the vital issues that really needs lots of discussion, because I think you're absolutely right. We had a totally chaotic, fragmented response to the pandemic, and it had these enormous disparities also on economic and ethnic and poverty, variability and inequities. And that's part of the system that's fragmented and disorganized. It's all, you mentioned that it's important that everyone be covered, and that a health service is really a useful thing. I think one of the drivers, in fact, of the pandemic in our country was the fact that not everyone is covered. And that means many things. It means that the public health officials are deprived of knowledge, because if people don't contact and keep the public health officials aware, they're sort of out beyond their vision. And so public health, which depends on accurate, timely, up-to-the-minute information and data, is moving blind through the pandemic. And so that's a terribly important problem. And we can see, as you're saying also, that the fragmentation of the system in a country like ours leads to very bad responses in terms of trying to deploy vaccines, and it leads to very unhappy results in terms from the beginning in terms of messaging, because there was no uniformity of messaging, whereas in countries like, let me take another European country, but because I lived in Italy during the spring and the first upsurge, and it was extraordinary to compare what a unified health service did in terms of just one message, informing the people every day, having all political parties unite behind this message, and explaining to people what they needed to do, and that this would be patriotically essential. It would save their individual lives. It would save their families, their communities, and the nation, and that none of this could be done without everybody implying the same measures, and these were the only tools that we had to deal with the emergency. So I do believe that centralized messaging is critical, one of the great lessons we need to draw from this epidemic. My own sense is that an ongoing health service would be quite preferable, because you then don't have, just in terms of an emergency response, you don't suddenly have to shift an entirely different organizational system. And I do believe that it would diminish, if everyone in our country were covered and had access to medical care, it would diminish those comorbidities that are also drivers of the pandemic in our country. So I'm entirely in favor of what you're saying, and I think it's really important, and that those countries that have a more central direction have all fared so much better than we have. And that's really paradoxical, because we are the center of, we are the preeminent scientific society with, in terms of research, in terms of medical research, and that's not matched by our performance when we were tested by COVID-19, and that's not because we don't have science and good hospital centers. It's because we were totally disorganized and had no centralized direction. So I think it is critical, and I do really hope that we do learn that lesson.
Yeah. I wonder if you could talk about the different ways pandemics end and your thoughts on could the coronavirus be here to stay?
Well, in fact, it's interesting that when people do raise the question how pandemics end, because the point there is that, A, they don't all end. They sometimes are with us for the long term. I'm not saying this in the spirit of Armageddon. I just mean that pandemic diseases often become endemic diseases afterwards and are still with us. Examples might be HIV/AIDS or malaria and tuberculosis. Those haven't really ended. They've become, if we like, at a much lower level than they were in the past and in times of great crisis. But we cannot assume that all diseases will become be eradicated, as it were. And indeed, there are only two diseases that we can talk about in terms of eradication so far. One, of course, is smallpox, which is the only disease which is actually, we can claim to have eradicated, only one. And then there's polio, which is perhaps on the verge of being eradicated. It was certainly demonstrated that it's possible to eradicate polio as well as smallpox. But not all diseases are capable of being eradicated that way, because this is something that is troubling to me in terms of COVID-19, where we hear this idea that vaccines should be able perhaps to eradicate COVID-19. Well, what makes diseases eradicable is that the vaccine is reproducing what nature already does. That is to say, in the case of smallpox and polio, you have a robust, durable, lifetime, and efficacious immunity if you've already contracted the disease. And so the task of the vaccine is to educate the body to reproduce what nature already did. But many diseases, if you contract them, they don't do that. You don't then have a long-term immunity, or it's not a very effective one. Malaria is a good case in point, and it's doubtful that we'll eradicate malaria. Cholera, or I think we could say, also hasn't led to an effective vaccine therapy. And I think we could talk about the role of seasonality in the short term, and in the long term about the sanitary movement, which has rid the industrial world of Asiatic cholera, though sadly not the global south. The Spanish influenza was driven by total war, and not by surprise, it began to decline with the coming of peace and faded away thereafter, with this no longer this great highway of transmission that was the movement of young men around the world to fight in the trenches. That was the driver, and when that ended, the disease faded away. COVID-19, I don't think, is going to be, it's what we're now learning with the emergence of various variants, is that there is a sort of race underway between vaccines and the emergence of new variants. And there is no reason to assume that COVID-19 will be defeated by vaccines alone. In other words, one of the things that is saddening is that in certain many countries, and certainly here, people seem to have the view that it's a magic bullet. And the WHO, for example, has played a very prominent role in conveying a different message, that we do need to be prepared for the long haul, not for lifetime, but for months and maybe a year or so more to keep going, not with the vaccines, yes, critical, but also in with public health measures. Even after vaccination, we should still maintain the masking and social distancing, for example, and improving ventilation in buildings and workplaces and schools. All of those are critical along with the vaccines, and we have to remember that we're a global world and that the vaccines can't be withheld from the global south, because we're all in it together, and the longer the disease is allowed to flourish in countries abroad, the more variants and will emerge. And it seems that the variants we have now are converging on finding mechanisms to become less vulnerable to immune responses of the human body. And so it's really important to minimize the efflorescence of these new variants. And that can be done, but we have to tackle that not just in one country, but as an international response of high priority.
We just about a minute left. We've been talking a little bit about lessons learned. Are you optimistic that we may handle future epidemics and pandemics better?
I would have to say that, yes, long-term I am. And I don't think that we're going to suddenly be organized and suddenly become sure about it. It will take a lot to set up a national health, universal care around the world. It will take a lot to be sure that we invest in preparedness. Those are lessons we need to take into the future, but we have the means to do that. We know what we need to do, and it seems to me that one of the silver linings in this dark cloud of COVID-19 is that it has been so ghastly and so long-lasting and had such a devastating effect on so many areas of life of everyone, that it may well be now that people will be willing to listen to science and to follow the changes that we all know actually work in the way that we live and conduct our business. And I feel that because this is nature that we're dealing with, if we don't do that, it will bite us. And we're beginning to see how that happens. And so I'm hopeful that, let us say, in the medium and long term, that a lot can and will be done.
Right.
So I'm qualified.
All right. Frank Snowden, author, and Andrew Downey, Orrick, Professor Emeritus of History and History of Medicine at Yale University, author of Epidemics and Society, From the Black Death to the Present. First Thursday of the month is our Marine Biological Laboratory's Falmouth Forum Lecture Series. We'll have more information at our website, capeandislands.org. Professor Snowden, thanks so much for being with us and for the work that you do. We really appreciate that. I'm Indy Todd. Thanks for listening.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.